Searching for Amelia on the island of New Britain. I'm Paul Plagg, and this is Aero News. . 2007 is the 70th anniversary of the disappearance of Amelia Earhart's Lockheed Electra. There's expected to be a great deal of interest around the world in this story again in this anniversary year. And among the people who have been spending years looking for this missing plane and the ending of the Amelia Earhart story is David Billings of the Electra Search Project on New Britain. We have David on the line now, and we're going to talk to him for a few minutes about this project. David, first of all, thanks for joining us and taking a few minutes to talk to our listeners about your project.
You're welcome.
Tell us a little bit of background on the Electra Search Project on New Britain. You're using some, you're inspired by some evidence that not everyone has focused on, and it has to do with Australian veterans who were in that part of the world in that era.
Yes, that's correct. In 1945, Australia, under the guidance of MacArthur, was taking back the territories which had been captured by the Japanese. And one of the jobs for the Australian Army was to retake the island of New Britain. And to that effect, the Australians were on the north shore of New Britain Island and on the south shore, and they bottled up the Japanese into the Gazelle Peninsula. And the best place to bottle them up was in the area of Wide Bay and Open Bay. Wide Bay on the south and Open Bay in the north. And this peninsula, the isthmus across the neck, is only 38 kilometers across. And it was an ideal place to position troops so that the Japanese couldn't filter out. So during one patrol in this area, and it was the first patrol that our veterans did when they got to New Britain, they were out on a reconnaissance patrol with 20 men and one New Guinea policeman as a guide, and they entered an area which was basically a no-man's land. The Japanese were still patrolling it, and they were told not to get into a firefight. So they carried out the patrol orders, and on the first night out, one of the guys that was clearing the front across a river was actually shot at, and he returned fire with his Lee Enfield rifle and actually shot one Japanese. He'd seen two in uniform, plus a native, and he heard a dog barking as well. So he rolled left and then rejoined his patrol, and the patrol leader decided that in the morning they would cross the river and search out where the little firefight had taken place and possibly track the Japanese, as it was an ideal opportunity to follow some Japanese to a concentration of Japanese. So that's what they did in the morning. They went across the river and started following the trails of these. One was wounded, could be seen to be being dragged, and they carried on following them until the tracks ended at a riverbank and the marks of a canoe were seen.
Did they realize on their own through clues on the ground, or were they told by their base camp that there might have been a larger group of Japanese waiting to ambush them?
No, they decided on their own to follow these tracks, and it was on the second night out where they camped by another river that they heard a scratchy message over their radio that they were being followed, and they decided to return to their base on the return trip by a different way. Obviously, if they'd have returned by the same way, they would have been ambushed, and it's very lucky that a connecting patrol that brought them a new radio weren't done so by the Japanese that were waiting. Obviously, they let them through, hoping to catch the larger bunch coming back. Anyway, it was on the different way back, which they called the alternate route, that they found the aircraft wreckage on the side of a hill.
All right, now, you've talked about on your website the aircraft wreckage itself and the consistencies with being a Lockheed Electra. There was a service tag that was recovered from the scene with some coating on it. Tell us about that.
Well, this tag was a metal tag which was wired to the engine mount tubing behind the engine. One engine was detached from the wreckage, and one engine is still attached. The warrant officer on the patrol examined the wreckage of the detached engine, and the nacelle on this detached engine had actually split open. And he remarked to me when I interviewed him that it was strange because the split had rivets either side of the split, and this is consistent with the nacelle structure of the Lockheed Electra, which was made in three segments of 120 degrees, fitting together around the engine. so that when he looked inside this split or gap, all he could see in there that identified the engine, because they'd look for a plate on the front of the engine, but they couldn't see one. All he saw dangling in front of him was a small metal tag, no more than about 2.5 inches long, which had a hole through it and was wired to the engine mount tubing. So he undid the wire and took the tag and put it in his pocket, intending to produce it when they got back to base. And he said at the time, he said, the tag didn't mean anything to me. He said it all it had on it was letters and numbers. He said, and there was no actual wording as such. He said, but it was just a string of letters and numbers. So we believe that when we found the patrol map when the patrol map was produced in 1993 and then examined minutely in 1994, the wording on the edge of the patrol map has such a string of letters and numbers on it. 600 HP S3H1 CN 1055. And that 1055 is actually the serial number of Earhart's aircraft.
Now, this tag was a service tag. It's thought to have been a service tag because while in Hawaii before this leg of her world travels, that plane had been ground looped and required extensive repairs.
Yeah, that's correct. And I kicked myself because being an aircraft engineer all my life, the very fact that this tag had an airframe detail on it, which is the CN1055, construction number 1055, besides the airframe information, it also had engine information, 600 HP, 600 horsepower, and S3H1, which stands for a Pratt & Whitney R1340 S3H1 engine. And as an engineer, I kicked myself because I couldn't figure out why airframe and engine information was together on the same tag until one night I went to bed, and I must have been thinking about it, and I woke up at 3 o'clock in the morning and woke my wife up and said, that tag off the engine is a repair tag. And that's how I came to realize that that's what it was. It was a nowadays, of course, we use cardboard tags, and we put all the information about the aircraft on it, hours flown, et cetera, et cetera. But in those days, that aircraft was rebuilt in the same factory that actually manufactured it. And when you're in aircraft manufacturing, you don't call an aircraft by its registration number. In this case, it would have been NR16020. But in a factory, you don't do that. You always call them by the hull number or the build number or the manufacturer's serial number. And in this case, that number was 1055. And that's why it's on the tag.
And that stands for a Lockheed Electra 10 and the 55th one
Model
built.
10. Model 10, 55th built, which was her aircraft. Her Model 10 was the 55th Model 10 built. Yeah, it's conclusive that. There's no other aircraft serial number that matches her aircraft. That is her serial number.
All right, well, you have some very compelling evidence that, if it's being interpreted correctly, could only be that aircraft. Let's talk when we come back from the break about how you intend to try to verify this now when you go back and what will be involved in your expedition.
Okay.
We're talking with David Billings of the Electra Search Project on New Britain, and we'll be back with more of this Aero News special feature in a moment. This AeroCast is brought to you by Aircraft Engine Services, makers of the aluminum V220 and V300T engines.
How smart is the engine in your aircraft? Automotive engineering has advanced so much over the past 30 years that you almost never have to raise the hood. Why can't an airplane engine be just as smart and just as reliable? Now it can. Check out the new V220 and V300T from Aircraft Engine Services and their state-of-the-art engine management system. Both the V220 and the V300T feature a fully redundant and certified engine management system that controls all engine operation parameters. This EMS includes a true FADEC that manages propeller pitch and other elements of engine operation not usually controlled by the EMS in piston aircraft engines. The EMS automatically provides an optimum fuel mix by constantly measuring the manifold pressure, ambient pressure, engine speed, and throttle positioning, and calculating the appropriate fuel injection injection timing for each cycle and cylinder. The AES V220 and V300T, as simple as a car's engine, but oh, so much more fun to drive. Check us out on the web at theaircraftengine.com or call us at 321-268-3718. Aircraft Engine Services, the shape of things to come.
At Cirrus Design, we don't ignore the fundamentals of aviation design. We just give them an ingenious new interpretation. The Cirrus SR20 G2. Interested in a substantial airplane that remains practical and affordable? Whether you're a non-pilot looking to begin flying lessons, a pilot needing personal transportation, or a fleet customer selecting the best plane to meet the demands of a multiple aircraft operation, consider the SR20 G2. To learn more, call 888-750-9927 or check us out on the web at cirrusdesign.com.
Okay, you got the license and now you're renting or even own a plane. Now what? Hi, I'm Tom Gresham, host of Wings to Adventure Television, and every week on the Outdoor Channel, we show you incredible places you can visit in your plane. Shot in spectacular high definition, Wings to Adventure captures cool planes, interesting people, and fly-in getaways you haven't heard of. Plus, we always have fun. There's more info at wingstoadventure.com.
Welcome back to this Aero News special feature. I'm Paul Plagg, and my guest on this one is David Billings of the Electris Search Project on New Britain. David, welcome back to our special feature today, and thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
I want to ask you a little bit about the geography of the area before we get into details of the expedition you want to take on. Tell us a little bit about New Britain, where it is, how far it is from you and from other places people might know.
Well, from where I am, north of Brisbane, New Britain is around about 2,500 kilometres away. And to get there, we leave from Brisbane to Port Moresby on the main island of New Guinea, and then fly by the country's airline from Port Moresby to Kokopo, which is close to Rabaul on East New Britain. East New Britain lies to the northeast of the main island of New Guinea, and the population on East New Britain is around about 350,000. The main town of interest on New Britain is Rabaul. Of course, Rabaul is quite famous from its World War II activities. It was occupied by the Japanese for 3 years, and many Americans were lost there, mainly air crew, who flew from Port Moresby in B-17s and B-24s to bomb Rabaul into submission. Rabaul has a magnificent harbour and is ringed by volcanoes, which unfortunately have been erupting again since 1994 and are in fact still smoking. One of them, Matapit, otherwise called Tavavur, is still smoking, and you can smell the sulphur from Kokopo, which is about 50 kilometres away across the bay. So we get to Kokopo, then we organise our rations and our jungle equipment that we haven't brought with us, organise all that, and then set off the next day in a helicopter for about 50 minutes to quite a remote area, which is inaccessible by road, and the only access for us really is helicopter. To get there by any of the means, by sea and going up the rivers, would take 2 to 3 days. So we cut that time short because we basically only go in there for 2 weeks at a time. It costs us around about $17,000 to $20,000 each time we go in there, US dollars, which we have paid for out of our own pocket. We've been sponsored once last year, fully sponsored, and that's the only time we have been sponsored. So I've been in there 10 times myself. Members of my team, other members have been in there 7 times, 8 times, and it's just basically bankrupted us. So, but we carry on. But now we look as though we're getting somewhere with funding, hopefully, which will come from the United States shortly. And then we can go back in again with the full magnetometer team.
I have a little bit of background in the mining exploration industry. And magnetometer surveys are frequently used to take promising-looking parcels of land and probe beneath the surface for particular mineral characteristics that could reinforce a hypothesis about the presence of mineral deposits. In this case, you're going to be actually looking for metal, refined metal plane wreckage.
Yeah, that's correct. We'll be looking for a concentrated ferrous deposit. And in the engines themselves, the two engines each weighed 865 pounds. And probably about 450 pounds of that is ferrous material, cast iron, steel, which will be in a concentrated piece that the magnetometer should pick up from that level, as I say, flying above the trees. It has been done before to pick up airplanes, pick up wrecks up in New Guinea. In fact, sometimes it interferes with mining projects because as the magnetometer goes over, it picks up an anomaly, and they go in and investigate it and find out it's a World War II wreck. So what we're hoping for is that the magnetometer will pick up two ferrous deposits only about 30 meters apart because the engines are quite close together, the one on the airplane and the one that's off the airplane. But there also should be a scatter of ferrous debris from the landing gear tubing and other metallic objects. And don't forget that aluminium itself does have a very small ferrous content. So there should be like a shadow on the ground when it goes over, when the reading is processed.
All right, so you have a fairly detailed profile to hand to the folks who do the magnetometer survey of exactly what they're looking for. You're going to be at 150 feet, which you say is, in some spots, treetop level with a helicopter. How much ground will you have to cover with this survey?
About 5 to 10 kilometers. We're hoping with the knowledge we have to hit it in the first couple of days, which will save us a hell of a lot of money. And the information from the veterans has sometimes been confusing, but some of the clues that they give in their ordinary speech pattern, when they say, oh yeah, when I was coming down off the hill, we could see a river bending, we could see river bends below us, those kind of glimpses only happen in certain areas, and you can actually vector in on where they might have been or what angle they were at or to a river and so forth, because the rivers basically have not changed their course in the, 56 years since they were there, 56, 58 years. So the rivers have not changed. It's only over long periods of time where rivers change their actual course. So there are quite distinctive bends in some of the rivers in there, which would show up from on top of a ridgeline or something like that if you get a decent sort of a look. Of course, you don't get that very often in the jungle. It's very, very difficult to see out unless you're really on a sharp ridgeline that you can actually look through the trees from the ridgeline and then down into a river. And those glimpses only occur very rarely.
Tell us about the project, what you need to accomplish before you can get in there. It looks like you're trying to raise about $100,000 U.S.
Well, no, it's gone up a little bit since then. To be sure, because we want to take the veterans in there, and they're both in their late 80s, but they're both keen to go back. And I have to cost the budget. I have to make the budget out to encompass taking the veterans up. I mean, it'd be a wonderful thing for them if they were there when it was found and could be filmed on site, for one thing. But they are, one of them is a little bit infirm, but the other one is quite robust, and they both want to go. What we plan to do is to, with the available $150,000, which we shouldn't use, and any excess, of course, will be returned, but for contingencies, we have to plan that somebody in our group, in the search group, is going to get injured, which has happened before. It's happened to me. I cut my hand open once in there, and I had to be choppered out. But you have to plan for these contingencies, and with taking the veterans up there, we also have to plan to fly them back to Australia, to Cairns, in case they get sick and have to end up in a veterans hospital. So we have to consider all this, and I have to pad the budget with this kind of money to make sure that for medical attention or hospital fees and things like that, that just for those contingencies, because it's quite dangerous in there. There are crocodiles in there. There are very, very large birds, cassowaries, which can give you a kick like a mule. There are sharks in the river. We have to get into the rivers occasionally, not so much this next time in the area we're going. But we have crossed one main river about 8 times in one day, walking across the bends. and later to find out that there were 6 or 7 feet bronze whalers in there. We didn't see any on that occasion, thankfully, but they are around. So it can be quite dangerous, so we have to plan for that. There's also the helicopter fees, which are quite horrendous at times, depending on how the dollar is going, because everything has to be paid for in U.S. dollars.
Right.
So what we have to budget for is a $1,200 an hour fee for helicopters. I think the last time in we paid $1,270 an hour for a long ranger, a Belgian three. Long Ranger 3,
mm-hmm.
and we can't carry everything up there from Australia. So, because the last time we went up there, we paid about $400 or $500 in excess baggage. So we're not doing that again. When we get to Kokopo, which is the town where we stay, that's quite an industrialized area, and you can buy anything there. So we buy all our rations and tools and stuff like that. At Kokopo, and then ship them out in the chopper. Usually takes us with five people we had last time in 2006. We had two trips in, and then gave a lot of our gear away to the local villagers, or left it there for them, and then told them where it was, and then chop it out in one lift. But if we require two lifts out, of course, that increases the fee by, it's four trips instead of three. So it's quite expensive to get there because the area is so remote. That is the main problem.
Tell people who are listening to this how they could get involved if they wanted to in terms of participating in sponsorship. Are you open to small donations?
I've always said I'm open to anything. The battle has been quite long and it's been uphill. And every little bit helps, as I say. But they can contact me directly. From the email address on the website. That is davidb236@aol.com. David B is in capital letters, 236@aol.com. Or they can contact the agent that's looking after us in Los Angeles. And she's a lady named Patricia Nell Warren. She's quite well known in America. She's an author and has her own publishing house. And she can be contacted at Patricia Nell Warren, which is all one word, PatricianellWarren.com. Patricia's been trying to find funding for us for about 18 months now, and it looks like she's had some success now. We're talking to a well-known film producer at the moment, and we're hopeful that he'll come to the party.
Well, it would make a great movie.
It certainly would. It has everything in it. I mean, it has Earhart for a start, Fred Noonan, the Electra, which was a magnificent aeroplane. And the thing about the aeroplane is that with what we're trying to do now, I know it's a long way for the Electra to get back to Rabaul, but the very fact is that between Ley and Howland Island, there were only two airstrips, and both of them were at Rabaul. One was Lacunae under the volcanoes, and the other one was Vuna Canal. So I believe that because of increased headwinds on the way out, the Earhart was actually short of Howland Island by as much as up to 200 miles. The very strange thing is that Fred Noonan was an excellent navigator, but if Fred did not get astro navigation throughout the night, in other words, celestial navigation, then he would be blind. As a navigator, he wouldn't have a clue where he was because he would have to be trying to dead reckon. And dead reckoning navigation is the least accurate form of navigation. And because the direction finder that was on Howland was out of commission, the batteries were flat, and the fact that her aircraft couldn't pick up on anything that was said by Howland, except that one time when they transmitted on 7,500 KCs and she picked up the letter A's on the DF aerial. That was the only time that they were actually in two-way communication. So I don't think that they got anywhere near Howland. And after searching for 1 hour, it's time to say goodbye, baby, and get back. And the easiest way to do that is to start her contingency plan, which is to return to the Gilbert Islands. But if she's short of Howland Island by as much as 200 miles. She's closer to the Gilberts than she thinks she is. She thought she was at or lateral to Howland, but that wasn't so.
Mm-hmm.
So if she turns around for the Gilberts and flies back to the Gilberts, it's possible that she could have overflown them. Fred Gurner, who worked for Columbia Broadcasting and wrote a book on this, in the first edition of his book, he said that Nauru Island picked up a call 24 and a half hours after the electorate left Lae, and that call was land in sight ahead, and it was on her frequency. And there were no other aircraft out there in the Pacific, so whose aircraft could it have been? Only Earhart's, and only on the return. And that's what I believe. I believe she returned. But the other thing is, the fuel was getting a bit thin. On her first attempt, when she flew from Oakland to Honolulu, she used a technique to slow the aircraft down, and that was at 10,000 feet. She didn't want to arrive in the dark at Wheeler Field, so she slowed the aircraft down till it was indicating 120 miles per hour on the airspeed indicator. And with that airspeed set, she was only using 20 U.S. gallons per hour. She says that in her book, Last Flight. She mm-hmm. says on page 37 that she's burning less than 20 gallons of gas at 10,000 feet. So that was one method that was open to her when her gas started getting low, that is to bring the speed back to 120 and use less than 20 gallons per hour. So she could fly for a long time on 20 gallons an hour. If she's got 200 gallons, she can fly for 10 hours. And at 120 miles an hour with a tailwind of up to 25 miles per hour, she's doing 145 miles per hour ground speed. So in 10 hours, she can do, 1,450 miles, I should say.
Right. You know, every time I talk to anybody about this mystery, I kind of close my eyes and start imagining. And I think it has that effect on people all over the world, especially in the U.S., because Amelia Earhart was so well loved and, frankly, so well promoted here. And you're onto something fantastic, and we wish you the best. We will keep in touch and see how it goes. I would direct our listeners to www.electranewbritain.com. That's all one word. And they'll find the complete story there and details on what you're looking for. David Billings, we wish you success. We thank you very much for taking a few minutes out to talk to our listeners today.
And thank you, Paul, very much indeed.
You can find more info at www.electranewbritain.com. My guest has been David Billings of the Electra Search Project on New Britain. And you've been listening to a special feature from Aero News. On the web, you'll find us at aero-news.net. I'm Paul Plack. Thanks for listening. Have a clear and unlimited day.